coming up on Golf Today. What does it take to be number one? Nelly can answer that again after winning the Pelican for the second straight year. An emotional win that brought her to tears in a challenging season. Is she all the way back? And Tony Finau remains in Fuego, a third win in his last seven starts after trouncing the field in Houston. Is the big man carrying the most momentum into 2023? And from journeyman to juggernaut, Stephen Auker goes from Monday qualifier to winning the Charles Schwab Cup in 15 months. We give some much-earned love to the Kiwi on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
I am very enthusiastic about First Tee. I believe it will expand interest in the game. But more important for me than that is lifting up the life of one kid. And we'll be lifting up the lives of a lot of kids by this program.
25 years ago, on November 13th, 1997, then PGA Tour Commissioner Tim Finchem was joined in New York City's Central Park by representatives from leading golf organizations, the LPGA, Masters Tournament, PGA of America, PGA Tour, and USGA, including the president, George Herbert Walker Bush, and golf dignitaries to announce the launch of First Tee. We're celebrating that milestone anniversary, 25 years this week on Golf Today. You see the notable achievements. Diversity, equity, and inclusion has been central to First Tee since its inception. 150 First Tee chapters opened in seven countries and four continents. Dave Manhack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. 25 years. I've met a lot of these kids. They're sharp. They're bright. They add a lot to us as people who love this game, who love playing this game, but also seeing young people knowing about confidence and how to treat people. I've met them in Villanova and Pebble Beach and Winter Park, Florida. This is an important milestone.
It really is. And we hear a lot of talk these days about growing the game, and a lot of it is lip service, frankly. But this is a program that actually has boots on the ground, and you can see the result of it. We've had people on this show who've gone through the First Tee program over the years, and it's remarkable how much of that stays with them as they move through college and on into their professional lives.
We'll continue to celebrate First Tee for much of this Monday. Now, before we get to some LPGA highlights from this week, I want to flash back, Eamon, to 2021, the Pelican Women's Championship. Nelly Korda defeated Lydia Ko, Lexi Thompson, and Se-young Kim on the first hole of a playoff for her fourth LPGA title of the year. She capped off a truly incredible season. Lexi Thompson, I tell you, this has been the part of the game that's let her down. She had a lot of opportunities last year to close out this victory. Instead, the door was open to Nelly Korda despite a triple on the 17th hole. She takes advantage in the playoff, able to get the job done. But first, Lexi had to miss one more putt. So you see the elation for Nelly, but it's been a very different story for her in 2022. She missed several months of play after undergoing surgery to remove a blood clot from her left arm, and then didn't get back to playing golf till the U.S. Women's Open in June. Just so strange seeing this young person, this picture of health, remarkable athlete, laid up in the hospital. So she did return to action, heading into the Pelican. Had not been playing that well, hadn't won on the LPGA Tour, did win once on the Ladies European Tour, had a couple of missed cuts, in fact, going in to the Pelican. But it's a victory for Nelly Korda, her first win since 1 year ago at the Pelican.
And here's a final look at that Pelican Women's Championship leaderboard. Nelly Korda on top, narrowly over Lexi Thompson. And a lot of action on Sunday afternoon there. Lizette Salas also played a pretty good round of 67 in there. And Maya Stark fell away a little bit on Sunday with a 10th place finish. And with the victory, Nelly Korda becomes the first player to successfully defend a title since Jin Young Ko won the 2020 and 2021 CME Group Tour Championships. The win marks Nelly's 8th on the LPGA Tour. And afterwards, she spoke emotionally with Angela Stanford.
Nelly, after everything that you've been through to start the year, how does it feel to get a win this year and to do it here at home?
Super nice, yeah. Has a nice ring to it. It's been really nice to see my parents. But, yeah, it's been tough.
but.
Well, you did great today.
Yeah.
7-under, bogey-free, first time to come from behind to win out of your 8 victories. Just awesome.
Thank you.
Also, you regained the number one spot in the world. Here, let me help you with those tears. let me just keep helping you with those tears.
Yeah.
How does it feel again, like, to regain the number one spot in the world?
Honestly, amazing. It's been a tough year. Lots of ups and lots of downs. Missed 2 cuts in Arkansas and Dallas, but kept my head high and worked really hard during my few weeks off, and feels really good to be back on top.
Very good. Well, with all this momentum,
yeah,
going into next week, you're playing for the biggest winner's check in women's golf. How does it feel? I mean, you get in your car and you drive down to Naples.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a great feeling taking the momentum down there.
For sure, yeah. I'm most excited about spending the night in my own bed tonight, and then I'll do some laundry and drive down tomorrow, hopefully fresh. But right now, I'm just going to soak this all up with my family, and next week's a new week, so I'm going to try to get back in shape and see how it goes.
As mentioned, Nelly Korda returns to number one in the Rolex Women's World Golf Rankings. She previously held that number one spot from June 28th through October 24th of 2021, and from November 8th of 2021 through January 30th of this year, for a total of 29 weeks. And Damon, that was a pretty emotional world number one we just saw collecting her first trophy in a year yesterday.
Yeah, to see someone who's at the top of their game, you know, she's the picture of health and athletic prowess, and all of a sudden she finds herself in a hospital bed and she loses number one. And it's not because she suddenly can't hit the ball in the center of the club face anymore. It's because she's sick. And to have the game taken away from you and you come back and you're not quite all the way back. She had a chance at Evian, looked very comfortable the first 2 days, maybe a little uncomfortable the second 2 days. She misses 2 cuts going in to Pelican and her title defense. And I think those tears were about this journey for this young player who in 2021 made it look so easy and effortless. And we know it's not, but to win 5 times, if you include that Olympic gold medal and a major championship at number one, and to have all that taken away from you, and you don't know the status of your game, the status of your life, and to be able to hoist that trophy again, it had to really have been an emotional walk and win for her.
And nothing really refocuses your love of the game than the idea that it could all be taken away from you. And we've seen that in the past with other players who've hit kind of health speed bumps along the way. We've even heard Tiger Woods talk about that and how much he actually wanted to play golf again when he realized he couldn't. And Nelly Korda was out for 17 weeks. That's a long stretch when you're young and you're at absolute peak of your game to suddenly be told that you can't play anymore. And I know she'd won on the Ladies European Tour, but on the more demanding precincts of the LPGA Tour, she'd had a couple of promising results, but it was still far short of the Nelly Korda that we had seen before. But this week wasn't short of that Nelly Korda. She missed one fairway in 54 holes out there this week, with rain shortened, obviously, because of the storm that blew through Hurricane Nicole. But her ball striking was so clutch this week. That was the Nelly Korda that we saw last year, the one that we thought was getting into this rivalry for the ages with Jin Young Ko. Jin Young Ko's kind of hit a pause button in terms of the dominance that we saw out of her. This kind of leads to a certain promise, though, because you've got Nelly Korda, who's back to number one in the world. You've got Lydia Ko, who's 1 point ahead in the Player of the Year race going into the last week of the season, who's back in winning form. You have players like Minji Lee. Jin Young Ko's right up there as well. Lexi Thompson showing form again. It's where we were last year. There's the promise of great head-to-head rivalries on the tour. Just not quite clear who's going to be in that rivalry yet.
The LPGA missed her. The golf fan missed Nelly Korda, considering what she did last year. And you just don't know. Even when you're 24 years old, you don't know what the kind of injury, what that means for your golf swing, for your life. And the assumption is, oh, she'll be back and she'll eventually win on the LPGA Tour again. But you don't know that, you know, deep down in your heart and your bones, what this injury could have meant for the rest of her future in the game. And also just in the tournament specifically, I was impressed with how she navigated, especially the back nine, and continued to keep, you know, Lexi Thompson in the frame. And on the 17th hole specifically, which really, you know, got her in trouble 1 year ago, she made a triple bogey on this hole. We talked to Bo Welling, the architect, and I just love the design, this short par 4. So this is where she made an absolute mess of things 1 year ago. Let Lexi Thompson back into the frame. Let Se-young Kim, let Lydia Ko back into the frame. So she's, you know, this was a nightmare scenario. She showed a lot of toughness last year when she found a way to make it into that playoff and ultimately win. And then yesterday, easily could have thought about the triple bogey from a year ago. Instead, she sticks it close, makes the birdie, as you said in the highlight, a four-shot swing on that hole on Sunday.
Yeah, some lessons are pretty hard learned in this game, Damon, and that was certainly one for Nelly Korda. And some credit as well to Lexi Thompson, because it would have been very easy to just fold after the bogeys on 11 and 12, and she showed tremendous character by then birdieing the next two holes. And that was a second place that was earned. It wasn't as though she handed away a trophy to anyone else. And for people who wanted and enjoyed watching two stars of American golf kind of fight it out down the stretch, that is also the first all-women's team in the QBE shootout next month.
No
Nelly
doubt.
Korda, Lexi Thompson.
Now it's time for Winning Moments presented by Win Grips. Finau par 4, 18th. Another one from distance, but this is just, you know, it's all academic at this point.
This one looked very good for very long, but just pulls away at the very end.
Look at that smile. Talk about somebody in complete control. He marked it, tapped in for par and the win, finishing at 16 under. Final round of 69, four rounds in the 60s. Third win in seven starts.
And with that closing 69 to take the Cadence Bank Houston Open, Finau becomes the first 18-hole leader or co-leader to win on the PGA Tour since the Rocket Mortgage Classic in July. The winner that time, also Tony Finau. Finau extends his stretch of winning at least once on tour to three consecutive seasons. After the win, he met with the media.
This is definitely the most all parts of my game have been clicking, but you know, I would say I've played a lot of good golf for a while. I didn't have a lot of wins to show for it, but I've pieced together a game, you know, and that's what you have to do out here, you know, with my experience. Again, as I alluded to, trying to be more of a precision player because I don't lack speed. So learning how to drive it in the fairway, you know, working on my wedge game, working on my putter, those are all things that I've worked extremely hard on, and I feel like I've been a very solid player for a long time, but it's exciting for me that I'm getting better, and that's all I can ask myself is try and get better in the areas that I really need to, and then remember why you are where you are. You know, I think I don't go too far away from the DNA of my game and how I see the game, and I think I'm kind of bearing the fruits of how I see the game now, and I'm able to hit the shots that I can see, which is pretty cool.
In a similar vein, mentally, is this the best you've felt knowing that you have the ability to finish off these tournaments?
Yeah, I've always felt like I've been very, very mentally strong, you know, and sometimes I feel like once my game matches up to my mental attitude, I feel like I can be a great player. You know, I feel like I've been a good player, showed some brilliance in spurts, but being consistently great takes a full game, both mental and physical. And I feel like, honestly, just my physical game is starting to match up to my mental. I feel like I've always been tough. I've always been strong mentally. Having a game that matches that, I think, is a great combination, and I'm starting to see that in myself.
Hot summer and autumn. Tony Finau, three victories in his last seven starts, and also came close, you see, at the FedEx St. Jude Championship as well as the Tour Championship. And Eamon, I love what he said about the physical game finally matching the mental game, because conventional wisdom was, well, he needs to get mentally tougher. And he's saying, hey, I've always been tough, but now I have the physical game to match.
Which is, it's striking, the comment he made on the 18th green after he won yesterday, where he said, confidence is contagious. Well, there are a couple of other things in this game that are pretty contagious as well, Damon, which is a cooperative putter and a straight driver. And those are two areas in which Tony Finau has really shown a tremendous amount of progress. Just this week, I mean, you can't rely too much on statistics this early in the PGA Tour season, particularly because his only previous start at Mayakoba didn't really gather a great deal in terms of shots gained metrics. But Tony Finau was typically, last season, he was 129th in driving accuracy on the PGA Tour. He was fourth this week, and this is while he's telling us that he's swinging within himself, that he still has a lot left in the tank while he's playing this kind of precision golf. And I actually heard our buddy Taylor Zarzar on Sirius PGA Tour radio this morning talking about how it looked as though Tony Finau is chipping a driver out there. And if you're chipping a driver as far as Tony Finau, is hitting it, you're in pretty good shape. His iron game has really been on song, but it was striking how well the putter performed for him this week. And if that's the sign going forward, then marry that with the confidence, then it's problematic for other guys, Hunter.
It is, and it sounds like a formula for winning major championships, because he's plenty long off the tee, but the perception would have been that 2022 for Tony's been about kind of bringing golf courses to his knees. But if you take a look inside the numbers, you're right. It is about how precise he has been. Look at his driving accuracy in the three victories. Tied for sixth, third, and first. Driving distance, yeah, he's long, but it's not like he's in top 10 in the driving distance of any of his wins. And look at that, greens in regulation. Tied for third, first, and first in the driving accuracy. It was like Fred Funk type of numbers. And to say that, hey, I can open up the tank when I need to. I can put the foot on the gas and go 330 if I need to. But he's much rather be 300, 310 in the middle of the fairway. And he's still long enough, but he's so accurate. I mean, that's been the key. It's been how accurate he's been off of the tee and to the greens. That's a very, very rare combination to lead in those categories.
And this is a guy who had this millstone put around his neck for so long that he couldn't quite close, that he was there every Sunday, it seemed, but never quite got the job done. Now he's not only getting the job done, he's separating himself from the field. We looked at those three victories there that Damon just brought up. He won the 3M Open by three shots. He won the Rocket Mortgage by five. He wins Houston yesterday by four. Tony Finau is a guy, when he's firing on all cylinders, then this is a guy you expect to win. And, you know, he won the Northern Trust in that great playoff with Cam Smith in the summer of 2021. Then he hit kind of a rut. He was in the top 10 in the official World Golf Rankings after that. Fell all the way down to 24th by the time we got to Augusta National for the Masters. Right now, he's back up to 12th, and that still feels kind of low for the talent pool of Tony Finau.
He's completely flipped the script on what people say about Tony Finau. And as I told Matt Adams, who was sitting in that chair a couple of weeks ago, he is a lock to be on the United States Ryder Cup team in Marco Simone in Italy. Are you on my
I'm on your side. I don't believe Matt Adams was on your side.
He was not. He was not. He said Tony had a little more work to do. I think that box has been checked. All right, folks, take a look now at the Comcast Business Tour Top 10. The reason this is so important, since 2009, every player who finished in the Comcast Business Tour Top 10 has made it all the way to Atlanta and Eastlake for the Tour Championship. So if players finish in the Top 10, odds are they're going to make it to the Tour Championship. Aiming everybody on this board, you know, a lot of smiles here, trying to lock up that Top 10, make it all the way to Eastlake.
Well, over on the silver circuit, Stephen Alker found $1 million pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. We'll have more on the winner of the season-long Charles Schwab Cup coming right up.
Hi, I'm Gary Woodland. I want to say congratulations to the first tee on 25 years.
Hey, this is Maverick McNeely. Just want to say congrats to the first tee for 25 years of service.
Congrats to the first tee on 25 years. Awesome organization.
Welcome to playing this wonderful and frustrating, but mostly wonderful game we get to play. I'm so glad you guys get to enjoy it.
Using golf to create a lot of value for kids.
It's amazing what you guys do. Thank you for growing the game. And keep up the great work.
Special week here on Golf Channel. We celebrate 25 years of First Tee. Since its launch in November of 1997, First Tee has grown into a preeminent youth development organization, boasting a network of nearly 150 chapters, programs delivered at 1,400 golf courses, 10,000 schools, and 1,700 youth centers in all 50 states in Australia, Canada, Japan, Korea, Mexico, and Morocco as well. So we'll continue to celebrate throughout the show. But right now, we turn our attention to the PGA Tour champions, what was at stake over the weekend at Phoenix Country Club and the Charles Schwab Cup Championship. Great duel highlights. You see the two principals, the protagonists there, Patty Harrington, Stephen Alker, Kiwi, who 15 months ago didn't even have senior status, Eamon Lynch. So here's Patty, par 4, ninth, his tee shot.
And Alker needed to get to fifth place or better to win the Charles Schwab Cup, even if Harrington wins the tournament. But Harrington wasn't giving much leeway today.
Yeah, this now four. But, you know, Patty has a lot of scrambling ability, trying to save par now on nine.
This is why he's got three major championships, Damon.
Yeah, you ain't kidding. I saw the one at Carnoustie and Birkdale, both of those up close. Now, here he is. Got a five-shot lead. So this is Alker now. He's got a terrible lie at this bunker.
It's a pretty great shot from where he was.
I agree with that. Can he save par? Stay five back. No. Yeah.
Keeps him at 19 under par, but Harrington was at 24 under.
Yeah, now the 12th hole. Walker trying to make a move.
This one is going to find the fairway bunker.
How's this lie? Oh, no, not very good. So he's going to bogey this to fall to minus 18. Harrington also on the 12th from the fairway.
Hitting it longer than ever at the age of 51. Great shot. He made that birdie. Got to 25 under in the lead. Was up to a half dozen.
Always love to work on his swing, work on his game. Here's Auker now, par 3, 13. This is for par.
Ooh. Cruel lip out on that one. He fell to 17 under. He's third place, but 8 back.
Third place still very important, though, to win the Schwab Cup. Now the par for 14th for birdie.
Yeah, it gives him a little breathing space. But he's still 7 back of Harrington, but in good place for the Schwab Cup.
Okay. Aforementioned Paddy, par 3, 15. This is lengthy. Call it a putt. It's from just off the green. It won't affect his putting stats in a negative way.
And he's chasing down a couple of scoring records. Oh. Jack Nicklaus and Tom Lehman.
That smile. 26 under for Paddy. Now here's the 16th par 4. Auker, his second.
And he sticks this one close. And the birdie gets him to 19 under par. And that Charles Schwab Cup is getting closer and closer.
Yeah, closer to his mantle. Now here's Harrington also on the 16th. Putting to the shadows. Always been a little uncomfortable for me.
Paddy doesn't look too uncomfortable. 8-shot lead at 27 under par.
Remarkable round, remarkable week. Now here's Auker for birdie on 18.
Didn't need it, but he does leave with a trophy. He has the Charles Schwab Cup.
How about it? So neat to see these two different player. I mean, you mentioned Harrington was wearing the World Golf Hall of Fame, 3-time major champion. Auker, who played all over the world, able to win the cup. Here's Harrington now. You want to talk about running away with it, getting it done. And what an asset for the tour. I mean, you just don't know. North of 50, will these players want to patronize PGA Tour champions? If you had no Paddy, would be one who want to do just that. Be able to get it done. For Paddy, wins the tournament historic fashion. You mentioned it, record-setting fashion. Largest margin of victory on PGA Tour champions since Bernhard Langer did so in the 2014 Senior Open. But the win Sunday was not enough for Harrington to take home the season-long Schwab Cup. Needed Stephen Auker to finish in a three-way tie for fifth or better. Auker shot 368 on Sunday to finish in solo third.
And let's take a look at the career trajectory of Stephen Auker. He has won 3 times PGA Tour of Australasia and on the Canadian Tour, 4 Corn Ferry Tour wins between 2002 and 2014. His senior tour career began when he Monday qualified into the 2021 Boeing Classic, finished tied 7th. 1 win, 9 top 10s at his first 10 starts last season, and look at this year in the PGA Tour Champions. 4 wins, 18 top 10s this season, so he's got experience of chugging out of a trophy. That's a sign that an American designed the trophy, because the Irish would never allow that much beer to pour out of the trophy before it reaches the mouth.
I mean, Shane Lowry, he did it right when he won that claret jug.
Shane would have caught that beer getting out of there.
Wouldn't have wasted a drop. And Stephen Auker not wasting this opportunity. The first line in the AP story, Eamon, was Stephen Auker played golf around the world on whatever tour would have him. I love that lead to the story, and it really tells the story of this player who 15 months ago had no status on PGA Tour Champions. Monday qualifies at the Boeing Classic, runs off 6 straight top 10 finishes, and not just rubbing elbows with the likes of Padraig Harrington and Bernhard Langer and Jerry Kelly and Steve Stricker, but on occasion and on certain Sundays, beating them.
And he's really a sign of how much of a closed shop the PGA Tour Champions is to get into. It's the toughest tour in the world to get traction on. Even guys who've won on the PGA Tour, they find it difficult to stay out there. So for a guy like Stephen Alker, it's quite remarkable. He's played on six different tours that offer world ranking points. He's played on developmental tours in every corner of the globe and started planning, he said, when he was 48 and a half. He had set an 18-month plan for what he was going to do when he hit 50. And what he's done since then is really quite remarkable. And the Charles Schwab Cup is the perfect prize for a guy like Stephen Alker because it rewards season-long consistency. He's made 23 starts this year, 4 wins, 4 seconds, 5 thirds, 18 top tens. Seasons don't come any more consistent than what Stephen Alker has put together.
This is someone who, during his PGA Tour career, 3 times earned a PGA Tour card and lost it that very same season. Didn't play well enough to keep the card going into the next year. 3 times, could have been knocked down, could have put his clubs away for good, and no one would have said boo. Says a lot about what's inside Stephen Alker.
It's nice to get a reminder that there are Cinderella stories in this game as well. It's not just everybody that's looking for more and more and more, that there are actually guys who've put in the work and ready to earn it. Well, coming up next, there were a lot of compelling stories yesterday. Pelican Women's Championship on the LPGA Tour, and the drama wasn't limited to the glamorous end of the leaderboard. Bethan Nichols will be here after the break to explain. Stay with us.
I've said it so many times, but it's just been such a roller coaster. I mean, I guess that's life, though. There's been more downs than ups this year, I think, and I think that's what makes this so much sweeter to me.
Sweet Sunday indeed for Nelly Korda, who won the Pelican Women's Championship for her 8th career LPGA Tour win, coming off a tough season on and off the course. But Sunday's win vaulted her back to number one in the Rolex Women's Rankings.
And now we have the CME Group Tour Championship this week, and let's see how the final list shook out in the race to the CME Globe. Lydia Ko topped that list behind the woman just bounced from the number one spot in the world rankings, Athaya Thitikul. And you see there at the bottom, Nelly Korda's victory got her up into the top 15, and they all start from fresh this week. And we're pleased to be joined now by my Golf Week colleague, Bethan Nichols. And Bethan, you were there yesterday to see the emotional scenes with Nelly Korda after that victory. Were the tears because she won, because she got back to world number one, or just because she thought it was all taken away from her earlier this year?
I definitely think it was all of the above, but the predominant emotion was one of gratefulness, I think, for sure. You know, there was a touching scene at the end when Nelly was outside the scoring tent hugging her father. And I talked to her father after it was all over with, and he said, you know, we're just fortunate that she's alive. You know, every perspective has changed so much in terms of health, of course, being everything. And there was so much uncertainty for Nelly in terms of whether or not she'd be able to play again this year. So, you know, she talked earlier in the week about maybe she had overdone it, trying to get back to where she was last year. And I asked her on Saturday afternoon, I said, you know, how do you feel like your game compares this week to this tournament last year, which of course she won. And she said, so much has happened then. She said, I don't even remember what my game was like a year from this point. But she said, my confidence certainly isn't what it was then because she'd won so much. And now I think we can say that Nelly Korda's confidence is certainly back after this victory heading into the last tournament of the season.
Bethan, does she strike you as a different person now for having gone through what she did this season?
I definitely think that this kind of situation changes a person forever, for sure, in a lot of different ways, and ways that we probably won't know because, you know, there are a lot of private things, you know, that she hasn't disclosed about exactly what that was like. But she has said many times that it was scary, and I definitely think that she'll, for the rest of her life, view her health and treasure it even more than she ever has before.
Bethan, that was the exciting end of the leaderboard yesterday, but there was no shortage of drama the farther down you went when players are essentially playing for their livelihood and keeping cards on tour. Was there any particular story that stuck out to you yesterday?
Yes, you know, we'll go to the feast first. And Morgan Mitrault, as a Swiss rookie who came in the unenviable spot of 101 on the CME points list, which, as you know, you have to be in the top 100 to retain full status, or else you probably will be going back to Q series. And Morgan not only puts up, you know, the best round of her career, 64, but then she vaults into a tie for four, which is her best finish. And easily moves into the top 100. And so for her, you know, it was a dream-like scenario at the end. And contrast that to earlier in the afternoon when Davey Weber walks off the course and she, you know, first of all, I commend her for talking to us right afterwards, because she was so frustrated that the decision that she made on the penultimate hole on the 17th hole, thinking that she needed a push to make birdie to move into the top 100 and keep her card. And really all she had to do was par the last couple of holes. And she ended up double bogeying 17th, trying to make something happen. And now we'll be going back to Q series. And she finished 101st on that list. So she took Morgan's spot there. And you know, but she said, to her credit, this is what we sign up for. We understand that this kind of thing could happen. And the other contrast, of course, the other race going on is trying to qualify for the final event, the CME this week. And when we look at Jenny Shin, a player who for the last decade has qualified for every season finale. And when she walked off the golf course, she said to me, you know, I haven't felt like this since I was a rookie. She said, I was thinking about qualifying on every shot. She said it was such a tough day. And you know, Jenny said that this year, when it was really interesting to hear her talk about the quality of golf throughout the tour, and that she really feels like when the top 50 in the world are playing week to week, you have to bring your B game to make the cut. And she said, it didn't used to be that way. And she said, my ball striking is actually as good as it was 6 years ago, better than it was 6 years ago when I went on tour. But the quality, the talent on tour is just so much deeper. And as for, you know, her missed cuts this year, she said, I turned 30 this year and I realized that, you know, I haven't made golf a top priority in my career many years because I wanted to enjoy life. And I really put a lot of expectations on myself this year. So I think it was a big learning curve for Jenny Shin. And I think look out for Jenny Shin next year. So unfortunately, she was the odd woman out this week, but I think it was a good experience for her.
What about Lexi Thompson, Beth Ann, another close call? Do you think this is scar tissue for her, or is this a feather in her cap for showing some fight, birding four straight holes, for example?
You know, this was a very different Lexi Thompson after the round this year compared to last year. Last year, it was complete and utter heartbreak after she missed so many short putts. This year, you know, she talked in the media for quite a while afterwards, smiles all around. You know, she played good in this final round. And in this situation here, when you see her, you know, hit the green, it rolls into the water here on the 12th. She rebounds here, salvages to make bogey, and really picked herself up and shook it off. And she said, in years past, I might not have done that after back-to-back bogeys. And so I really think, you know, she's showing, you know, everybody, we can all grow and mature, right? And she's continuing to do that. And I also think it helps having her brother Nicholas on the bag. He's been on the bag for a while now. He was with her when she won on the LET in New York earlier this year. And he's going to be on the bag again this week in Naples. And so I think she feels a huge comfort factor with Nicholas. They practice together all the time. And you know, he keeps it light out there.
What about that heartbreaking finish from Maria Fassi, who will not advance to the winner-take-all CME Group Tour Championship? How did she take the week? Because it looked like for a while, especially early in the tournament, she'd have a chance to win the tournament.
Absolutely. The conversation around Maria, unfortunately, changed dramatically from trying to win to just trying to qualify for CME. Of course, you know, Maria is always going to sign autographs after the round and put on a smile. But, you know, this had to be a big gut punch because, you know, she was in that last spot coming down the 18th hole, and all she had to do as well was par. And it didn't happen with back-to-back bogeys to slip her outside of getting into the CME. So, you know, I know Maria will use this as a learning experience, and she has a lot of people that will, you know, pump positive things in that 62. You know, you can take a lot of good things from that start, and this will just be a building block for her, but certainly something that she'll be thinking about for a while.
Bethan, you had a really interesting piece in Golf Week over the weekend about the distribution of prize money on the LPGA Tour and how you don't really have to work your way down the prize money list every week to get to the first woman who starts to lose money on the week with the expenses. Mm-hmm. And it was a conversation you'd initiated about whether or not it needs to be more evenly distributed, the prize money. You got some pretty interesting opinions from some top players who you would expect and assume would want the money to stay at the top of the heap.
Yes, Nelly Korda wants the money to stay at the top of the heap, and she actually feels like if purse distribution were to change, which just to give a little bit of a background here, the PGA Tour gives the winner 18%, the LPGA 15%, and Amy Olson, who's been on the board, veteran player, and also a CPA, she's looking at the broader picture. She wonders if the LPGA should drop it down to 12% because, you know, the majors and Terry Duffy and CME are really moving the needle in the purses and these huge paychecks, like this week with the $2 million first place prize. But really, the vast majority of the tour is lagging behind in a big way. And then when you bring in inflation, you know, it travel costs are soaring, and it's so hard for a lot of players to make a living that are, you know, between 100 and 150 on the money list. And so, you know, Nelly, you know, said, I think it would be a step backward if we were to do something like that. Lydia Ko says, you know, it sounds really shocking to take money away from the winner, but I also see that, you know, this might be a necessary step to make it so that when you do make the cut, you're guaranteed to actually turn a profit that week and not lose money, so that for a lot of those players, they can play the next week. So there are a lot of things in play. You know, I know that the LPGA commissioner, Molly Marcuse-Amon, is looking at this with guaranteed minimums now being offered in the men's game. It's a big talking point on the LPGA. Should there be stipends? Should the cut move from top 70 in ties to top 60 in ties? Should we take money from the top 10 and push it on down the list? There are a lot of options. Maybe none of them will happen. Maybe one of them will.
Fascinating conversation, I imagine, will continue. Beth Dan, thanks for the time. Have fun in Naples. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
I'm Austin Smotherman, and congratulations, First Tee, on 25 years.
Hi, I'm Taylor Montgomery. Congrats on the 25-year anniversary.
Here's to the next 25 years, and I'm happy to be a part of it. It's a big part of my junior golf growing up.
It's a place that I'll remember forever. I have some good memories, met some good friends out there, and I hope it continues to grow.
And I want to be here without him, so keep it up, keep doing all the good work.
How about notable First Tee alums to earn PGA Tour cards? Scott Langley, Cameron Champ, Austin Smotherman, who you heard from a moment ago. You hear from him again tomorrow. He's going to join us, the SMU alum and winner on the Korn Ferry Tour back in 2021, the Simmons Bank Open. And speaking of players who are looking to make it to the next level, last week wrapped up the final stage of Korn Ferry Tour qualifying school, players competing to determine their priority status for 2023. And I tell you what, the medalists received the fully exempt status for 2023. The finishers 2 through 10 and ties are guaranteed entry into the first 12 events of 2023. Then 11 through 40 and ties are guaranteed entry into the first 8 events of the 2023 Korn Ferry Tour season.
And here are some of the notable players who earned some guaranteed tour starts on the Korn Ferry Tour. Next week, Curtis Luck, former U.S. amateur champion Willie Mack, friend of the show from last week. You see the name there, Davis Chatfield. Only 4 men began all 4 stages of the Korn Ferry Tour qualifying school and made it through, and he is one of them. The winner of the Rhode Island Amateur back in 2016, played his college golf at Notre Dame, reached the round of 16 at the US Amateur quarterfinalist the following year in 2021, and as we said, reached all 4 stages and progressed through all 4 stages. And we're pleased to be joined now by Davis Chatfield. Davis, congratulations on the result. I'm curious if there was one point in those 4 stages of Q School that was more nerve-wracking than anything else for you.
To be honest, it was going into the final round of final stage there. Everyone knew it was on the line. It was tough. Every stage was tough. It was a grind. You know, my pre-Q started back in August now, so it was almost 2.5 months ago. And there was just a long wait in between every stage. But going into that last round, it was nerve-wracking for sure. It was the first time, obviously, I'd been in that situation, but I just had to rely on all the prep work that I had done. And, you know, luckily I stuck to my game plan and got it done.
That's the thing about Q School. It's like a dentist appointment. It's on the calendar for months before you know you have to go. What are the weeks like leading up to Q School?
Just a lot of prep work at home. You know, up here, I'm from Massachusetts, and there wasn't really much to play in, to be honest. So I just had to make sure every time I went to the course, I was getting something done that was productive. And, yeah, it was a waiting game for sure. There was about a month in between pre-Q and first stage, same from first stage going to second. But, yeah, I'm just glad it's all over with, to be honest with you.
So you got through pre-Q, first stage, second stage. And after second stage, you were quoted as saying, a week ago I had nothing, now I have Corn Ferry status, because you had at least conditional status from getting through the second stage. What was plan B going to be if at some point you hadn't been able to run the table the way you did?
To be honest, I didn't have any plan B at that point. I didn't know what I was going to do. It was my first couple months as a professional, and I had my eyes set on trying to get status on Corn Ferry for next season. I probably ended up, you know, I would have done Latin America, I'm guessing Q School, but I was just trying really hard to just focus on the one goal that I had at stake. And, you know, this time it worked out.
Davis, I heard of your older brother, Patrick, looped for you, and I heard you describe your need for a caddy thusly: I don't need to be talking about every other shot because you can get into this pit of overthinking. What did you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I like a caddy out there that can just kind of keep me loose and keep my mind off of everything else that's at stake. And, you know, we try to talk about everything that wasn't golf related. Cause you know, if you're out there and things start to go south and you start thinking about where you are in the tournament, or, you know, how many shots you need to get inside of that top 40, it can become, you know, a pit of, you know, a kind of a disaster, honestly. And I play my best golf when I have a free mind and I have no expectations. And he kept reminding me of that, and he was a great caddy to have that week.
It's very hard not to put emphasis on a particular shot, good or bad, David, when you're going through all of these stages of Q School with hundreds of competitors around you. Was there one particular moment along that journey where you thought the odds are in my favor, or was there one moment where you thought it was slipping away from you?
Yeah, I mean, I got off to a pretty bad start that last round of final stage, and it was kind of unlike the other stages. I had played really well in the last round. So at one point I was, I think, a shot outside of in the top 40 with five or six holes to go. And at that point it was tough. You know, I was like three over on the day, but that's when you have to remind yourself why you're here and why you put in all those hours of practice over the last, you know, 15 plus years. So that's when Q School becomes a mental game. That's when you have to rely on all the years of hard work, and I was able to do that.
Davis, one of my great regrets in life is that when I did a feature on Tyrone Willingham, who was the head coach of Notre Dame football, when I was writing for the Times, I didn't stop and play the golf course on campus, which is one of the great gems in all of college golf. Just, you know, give a plug for that golf course that you got to play day after day in South Bend.
Yeah, the Warren is it's special, and the staff out there keeps it in great shape year round, especially for us on the team. And you know, to play that course every day, it's hard to not get better. And hats off to the maintenance over there; they do a great job of keeping it ready for us, especially come springtime when we're getting a couple feet of snow every week. So it's a special place.
Well, Davis, congratulations on making it through the gauntlet that is Q School. Best of luck on Corn Ferry Tour, and we'll speak to you soon. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, coming up, David McLay Kidd. He's authored some of the finest golf course designs in the world, not the least of which was Bandon Dunes, which launched the famous Oregon Resort back in 1999. He's going to talk design, distance, and what he's learned along the way. Coming up next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Back on Golf Today, David McLay Kidd, born and raised in Scotland, pictured here with his wife Tara and World Golf Hall of Fame member Tom Watson. David is the son of a golf course superintendent, studied horticulture and landscape design at Riddle College on the outskirts of London. He's the architect of Bandon Dunes, which opened back in 1999, and today has more than a dozen courses on his resume. You see Bandon Dunes, Mammoth Dunes at Sand Valley, Nenea Golf Club, and yes, the Castle Course at St. Andrews as well. Now, Kidd and his team have recently broken ground on a new project in the Nebraska Sandhills called Gray Bowl, the Dormy Network Club. It's near Maxwell, Nebraska, with a planned open date of 2024. And David McClay Kidd joins us now. David, great to see you. Most people here in Nebraska, and they think college football, or at least they used to, tough times for the Cornhuskers, but the state also has a strong golf pedigree. I'm curious, what excited you the most about this project?
Well, for those that don't know, the western side of Nebraska is covered in sand. And any passionate golfer knows that sand makes for great golf. So the very middle of the United States continent has a giant area called the Sandhills. It's something like 400 miles wide and 200 or 300 miles tall. I don't know the exact dimensions, but it is immense. And of course, it's extremely remote. But as we all know now, remote can sometimes be a benefit for golf.
Well, David, I understand you actually weighed in on where the golf course would be planted because the initial site, there was too much clay. What happened there?
You know, I'd been talking to the Dormy Network for a while about finding a site in Nebraska, and the first sites that they showed me were on the south side of the Platte River, and they were sort of steep and heavier soils and a lot of invasive vegetation. So I persuaded, if you like, or at least I promoted strongly that we should be on the north side of the river where all the sand was, and it didn't take too much. And then we started a pretty extensive hunt for the Goldilocks site. We wanted something that was, you know, roly-poly. We wanted the dunes to be big but not too big, you know, far apart but not too far or too narrow. We wanted it to be not too far from North Platte itself where you land. So finding all of the requirements of the perfect site for golf, eventually the Dormy Network found one. Late last year, and we started construction this spring.
David, as you know, architects don't often get to choose their own site and certainly don't have that kind of latitude where you're in on the search process for it. Have you ever had any kind of job before where you had that much latitude in terms of where the course was going to be built?
Not very often. You know, I did a course in Hawaii for Chuck Schwab and George Roberts a long time ago called Nenea. And they didn't have an exact site. They had a sort of 8,000-acre parcel that they could look within. But when I looked at that, it all looked pretty much the same to me. I said, you guys pick a spot. It all looks like lava. So I can't think of many other times where I got to really range around a whole district and be very picky about what the best site was. We should do it more often. Developers should hire architects more quickly and have them on board and let us help in that process, because the cost of construction can vary massively between a good site and a bad site. I mean, literally 3 or 4 times difference in money between a really good site and a not so good site.
Where are you right now with the Gray Bowl golf course? I know whenever you leave us, you're flying down to Nebraska this afternoon, but how much work has been done so far?
You know, I keep having to pinch myself and my little team building this golf course. We keep having to remind ourselves that it really is this easy because the site is so good. We started shaping back on June 6th and we are 14 holes shaped out through the whole golf course in just that amount of time. And we only really have 2 main shapers on the site. So it is going extremely quickly because the site is so good. We will start planting grass May 1st next year, assuming the weather allows. And by the end of next summer, we should have the whole thing grassed and should be open the following summer.
Speaking of the weather, what are the challenges of building in a climate where the temperatures drop below freezing? Are you out there in mittens and a beanie sometimes? Is there a level where it's too cold and you say, guys, you know, let's take a day or a week off?
Oh, no, it never gets, I mean, this time of year it's cold, but the guys are all in modern equipment. I mean, the equipment, one of the guys, Ernie Paul Barari, is one of the shapers I have out there who's worked with me for 20 years. And I asked him the other day, hey, Ernie, how's that machine doing? Is everything okay given the bad weather? He said, yeah, you know, it's okay. I got one small complaint. One of the back left speakers is rumbling a little bit. I can't get my music to sound so good. So These guys in the modern equipment are a little more spoiled than they were 20 years ago.
David, when are we going to see you working on the East Coast or perhaps even the Southeast of the United States? Because so much of your work has been done kind of west of the Mississippi, really. I think the furthest east you've actually been is Mammoth Dunes at Sand Valley, right?
Yep, that's true. We did agree to do one project outside of Tampa. So we're working on that right now. We also are looking at a project in Austin. So we're slowly moving east. It's funny that a guy from Scotland moved all the way west and then has trouble moving back east again. That seems ironic.
David, you mentioned about the remote aspect of this project. How much does the Bandon story kind of tell you that it doesn't matter how far a golf course could be from a big-time airport, that if the golf course is of quality, the people will come?
You know, I heard Mike Kaiser say, you know, a year ago or so, that if you build a compelling golf course in the continental U.S., it almost doesn't matter where it is these days. There are enough golfers who will beat a path there that if the golf course is good enough, it will succeed. And I think he's entirely right. If the golf is good enough, modern transportation and the passion for golf means that golfers will find a way. They'll beat a path to it. You know, look at Bandon Dunes, Stream Song, Sand Valley. And it's amazing how far people will go for really good golf.
Well, David McClay-Kidd is going to stick around with us right now. We've got some big hot button issues in the world of golf we want to ask him about. So we'll be right back. We've been talking with David McClay-Kidd, who's easily identified here, the Scotsman in the kilt, standing next to his father, Jimmy, legendary Scottish golf course superintendent. In the centre there is Mike Kaiser, who famously developed the Bandon Dunes Resort, and he is flanked with his sons, Chris and Michael.
And the namesake of BMK Golf Design, born and raised in Scotland, as you mentioned, the son of a golf course superintendent, studied horticulture and landscape design at Riddle College in London. His notable courses include Bandon Dunes and the Castle Course at St. Andrews.
We're back with David McClay-Kidd. And David, you've been pretty open in talking about the trajectory of your career and how you hit that home run at the start with Bandon Dunes. And then you went through a down period before you got back up on top with courses like Gamble Sands and Mammoth Dunes. How do you look at the trajectory of your career? What did you learn during that downtime? Did it change the way you approached the job or your attitude to it?
It took me a while to figure out what I actually knew. As a Scot, I'd been raised on a diet of very simple, natural golf that appealed to most every golfer, whether it's granddad or grandson. And when I came over to the States, you know, I was indoctrinated with this whole harder is better. And I think for a while, for maybe as much as a decade, I sort of chased that objective, which I now, another decade later, see as complete folly. You know, you think about the golf courses that truly succeed. They are places like Bandon Dunes that most people enjoy. The problem maybe is that the ones that the US Open are played on are extremely difficult, and they're not usually every man golf courses, and yet they're the ones that get the most press. So my clients and the magazines, etc., often look to those as being the perfect template for golf development, and they really aren't. If we built Oakmonts every day, people would give up golf really fast.
One thing you hear, and I've experienced this personally, is how fun Bandon Dunes is, how playable it is. But at what point in that project did you realize you were building a course that would become so popular as a bucket list destination for so many people?
Oh, I don't think any of us did, even Mike Kaiser. I don't think any of us realized it while we were doing it. We were building something that, you know, we thought was cool, that Mike Kaiser was desperate to build because of his passion for golf in Britain and Ireland. But I don't think we thought that it would appeal to the masses. I mean, back then in the late 90s, the icon of golf was still Augusta. You know, everybody perceived that that was your perfect model. So Bandon Dunes is like the antithesis of that. It's completely the opposite. And so I don't know that we ever really thought that people would embrace it. And it was kind of a shock when almost as soon as it opened, it really appealed to people. It really showed that there was a yearning for adventure and an experience with nature that hadn't been around for, you know, a generation in golf.
David, you were still in your 20s when you first got involved with the Bandon Dunes project. You're 55 now. What does 55-year-old David McLay Kidd wish he'd known when he was in his 20s that he knows now?
Boy, I could write a book on that one. I think that the 25-year-old David Kidd was working all on instinct. You know, son of a Scottish greenkeeper, I'd been around golf my whole entire life, literally. And I had a lot of knowledge that I wasn't aware of. It wasn't sort of intellectualized. It was just instinct. And then as I got into my mid-30s to early 40s, you know, I was trying to use all of these skills I had learned and intellectualize the process. And in so doing, I was losing the instinct. And I in my early 40s, I went back to that and said, you know, what did I know at 25 so well that I didn't seem to know at 40? And that's when I went back and really started to think about why is Bandon so popular? And that led to building, you know, Gamble Sands and Mammoth Dunes and a whole load of other courses that I could mention, where when we complete it and the players go play it, it's a revelation to them. They say, I've never had so much fun. I'm 70 years old. I don't hit the ball 40 feet in the air, and yet I can find ways into these greens. I can get close to pins. I can actually play a set of tees that I have fun on. And these were all things that I instinctually knew and then somehow didn't pay attention to, wandered off the script. And I blame it on my desire to play that game that others were doing, building harder golf courses for the most elite players, which is a tiny percentage of the golfing population.
How about the culture of golf in Scotland? So much different than here in the United States, especially in terms of public aspect of the game, the cost, often private here in the States. Do you see the cultures getting closer together, or are they still pretty distinct in your mind?
I think they're probably pretty distinct. I mean, golf in the British Isles, as Eamon will attest, is an everyman sport. It's a common thing. I mean, to be on the high school golf team is as common in Scotland as being on the high school football team here in the US. There are so many more golf courses and the access is so much easier. You know, maintaining a golf course costs a fraction of what it does in the US. So it may be improving a little bit in the US, but I think it's challenging because of the nature of a lot of the terrain that we build on. The golf courses cost a lot to build, they cost a lot to maintain, and thus a lot, you know, a relatively large amount to play. That's just the nature of it.
David, the distance debate has remained a fairly hot button issue with architecture buffs for a long time. At this point, it seems as though we might be getting closer to a point where we hear from the USGA and the RNA on this. To what extent have you had to change how you design golf courses based on how far even recreational players hit the ball now, if at all?
You know, I don't know that the recreational player is really hitting it that much farther. I mean, over the last 20 years, you know, when we built Bandon Dunes from the green tees and it opened in 99, the green tees were 6,300 yards. They are still 6,300 yards today, 25 years later. And I don't see a bunch of players at Bandon saying, oh, I just wish I could play it longer. The course goes all the way back to 7,400 yards. I don't see many people trying to get back there. So for the average player with a sub 100 mile an hour swing speed, I think the equipment has helped, probably straightens things out. But I don't know that the average player is hitting it that much farther. Elite players, yes. You know, we're still building sets of tees where we used to be building a 7,000 yard course and then we went to 72. You know, now we're up at 74 as a minimum, 76, 78, depending on altitude. So yes, when the elite players are going to be participating and there's a focus on that, we are building golf courses that continually get longer. And that means that they take up a lot more ground and cost more money to build. That one little tee out there still has to be cleared in front of it, still needs to have irrigation, still needs to be mowed. So and still takes up a lot of ground. So all that length eventually the elite players hitting it farther and farther and farther does bring obsolescence to golf courses that might only be 30 years old, and some of them can't get extended. So where will it end? I guess we'll see. Limiting the golf ball would be my idea.
Well, we've talked a lot in this interview about things that have changed, whether it's distance or even your own design philosophy over the years. But one thing that hasn't changed is criticism. And I'm curious how you deal with it in your business, because you put years into pet projects like this where you spend hours of your life there on site, and then it opens and someone comes along and says, yeah, I don't like that very much. How do you deal with the criticism of it? Is it hard not to take it personally?
I'd love to say that it's you know, it's water off a duck's back, but you're absolutely right, Eamon. This is something that takes years. In my 30 years of working in this business, I now know that it takes about 5 years on average from starting a project to completing it. And I can only do, you know, one or two a year. I have about 25-ish projects in my portfolio. So there is a huge amount of effort and emotion poured into these things, not just by me, but by my whole entire small crew. Could be a dozen people. And then to have a journalist probably come, and he played it on a rainy day and there was some kind of maintenance issue, and for whatever reason, you know, they say something negative. That it's not easy. It's hard to, you have to do, you have to look to the bigger picture, which I've probably learned as I got older, which is, you know, what are the players saying? What are the everyday player who's the member or the guest? What are their opinions? Am I hearing the same criticism over and over? Or am I hearing the vast majority of players say how much they enjoyed it, how much fun they had, how they wanted to play it again? Those are the things that I gravitate to now. If I hear that, then it doesn't really matter where in the Golf Digest rankings a course might fall. I mean, it might be important to my client, but I think long term, what's more important is that the golf course is fit for purpose, that the vast majority of golfers are having fun. If you don't achieve that, then what else matters? If you're a modern golf course and you're ranked in Golf Digest top 50, but the vast majority of players do nothing but lose balls and never want to go back, is that really the measure of success?
Mm. Well, David, you brought a lot of joy to a lot of people. Best of luck with Grable. By the way, temperatures in North Platte currently 24 degrees, so you might need to zip up that jacket. We'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, don't go anywhere. Got the 9 best shots of the week when Golf Today returns. Find out what makes our list.